It's time for the best 60 minutes of your life. This is the Homer Hour, broadcasting live from the Gruber Law Office's One Call That's All studio at the Avenue in downtown Milwaukee. Alongside former Badger and Packer Gary Ellerson, here's Emmy Award winner Homer.
Minutes of your day, the Gary Ellerson Homer Hour. Unfortunately, Gary Ellerson is on assignment, so it will be the old-fashioned Homer Hour, similar to the way sports talk was done when I started in Milwaukee in 1989. After, since we were able to touch base with him, the doctor of pitching, Jerry Augustine. I guess you have to be old enough to know he pitched for the Brewers. But with the pitcher that I just referred to as Smoke, when you throw 102 miles an hour, or he did, Jacob Mizorowski, I just call you Smoke. Because everybody that goes to watch him pitch is going to see him throw smoke. And what does smoke really look like? Does it look like in the little league where you have somebody that is just so much better that the ball hits the glove before the hitter starts the swing? I don't know. But joining us now is the doctor of pitching, Jerry Augustine. Doc, good evening.
It's good to be with you. You know, my old saying was, you know, as hard as Mizorowski throws, I threw as hard, it just didn't get to the plate as quick.
All right,
and
now
that's
let's.
Just part, that's just
all right,
part
Jerry
of the
Augustine selling himself short, pitched, I believe, the quickest complete game in Brewers history, right?
Probably could have been. I think it was an hour and 36 minutes ago. Three hit shutout against the White Sox. I think it was something like that.
Yeah, there we go. Let me check and see what you got here. Jerry Augustine, it says you are 72. That sounds about right.
That's about right.
All right. And you pitched in the big leagues. Your debut was September 9th, 1975, similar to Jacob's major league debut. Were you nervous?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Well, you know what? I had pitched a couple times in relief, and that really helped me a lot. I pitched against the Orioles to start, and then I went against the Yankees. I pitched against Boston, I think, maybe before that.
So your debut would have been as a relief pitcher.
Was as a relief pitcher, but then we were flying home from Boston, and Del Crandall came up to me and asked me what I was doing that night, and he said, "Well, you better be at the ballpark because you're starting." So it was so much fun. It was beyond what I can even believe that I had so much fun, and it worked out really well.
All right, for people who don't know, you pitched in college at UW. Let me see,
La Crosse.
I was going to say Oshkosh, but just to make you mad. Did Oshkosh dominate then and kick your butt all the time, or was lacrosse actually any good?
No, it's actually every time we played, it was Augustine against Gantner. So there was a lot to it. I think a couple years that I was at lacrosse that we won the conference, and a couple years they won the conference. So we were so evenly matched, and we both went to the playoffs, and it was always fun. And that's one way I got to meet Jimmy Gantner, and we got to be friends even before we got drafted by Milwaukee back-to-back, so it was pretty special.
All right, talking with the doctor pitching, Jerry Augustine, because Jake Mizorowski had his major league debut last night, threw 102 miles an hour. I guess the first thing that I want to address is I don't believe these numbers. This isn't about Mizorowski. I see all these athletes and all different things, and there's just so much similarity to the great ones going back how many years. I just can't, because nobody threw it 102, right? The only pitcher, there was maybe Ryan Dern, Nolan, maybe there was, but they talk about It's a daily affair of somebody pitching in the high 90s, if not 100. Take it away, Doc.
Yeah, you're right. You know, and I think you go back and you even have a guy like a J.R. Richards who was like 6'8" and threw BBs up at the board. I think guys threw hard. I know Nolan Ryan threw awful hard.
But they never said they threw 100 miles an hour, and there were guns back then, right?
No, they. You know, there was games when I saw when they registered Nolan Ryan at a 101 and 102. It's a little bit more. I think the guns have changed a little bit. I think you've got a little bit of hype in the guns today, which makes it fun for the fan and the sport. But, you know, it's Homer, everybody talks about the velocity of the ball. And the guys throw hard. There's no doubt. The guys that you say can throw 98, 99, 100, 101. Yeah, that is special. They have a great arm. They got good velocity. But it's not just about the velocity. It's about the movement and the location. And that has as much to do with how good a pitcher is, how good he can throw. Paul Skenes from Pittsburgh, you watch him. He has great movement on the ball. You watch Mizorowski last night. A lot of velocity on the ball, but had great movement and great location. It's not just the velocity that you see and how you can reach back and get a little bit extra. That's fun to have because you can use it. But it's also that ability to make the ball move and locate it. And I think that has as much to do with the velocity that they talk about today than anything.
Talking with the doctor of pitching, Jerry Augustine. All right. How fast did they say was the fastest you ever threw?
94.
94?
Yeah. In Homer, it wasn't like, you know, Augustine went out there and he was 93, 94. No, it was maybe, you know, maybe five pitches my whole career that I threw up to 94. I was a 91, 92 guy with a lot of movement. I pitched by movement. I was the kind of guy that had to locate the pitches and get ground balls. And that's the way I pitched. I wasn't a velocity guy. I was a guy that could throw strikes, get ahead of guys, and shorten the game as much as possible. I was a guy that, you know, you see guys go out to throw that can throw, like Priester, he can throw good ground balls. He's 59% ground balls. I was that style guy. I was a brown ground ball guy.
Everybody, I mean, I can't speak because I'm not a pitcher, but I'm going to anyway. Everybody wants late movement. That's the most important thing, and it's not even close. The later the movement, the better. To me, I don't even care what Greg Maddux threw. All I know is, with my eyes, he had movement as late as any pitcher I ever watched.
Well, you know what, and the one thing great about Greg Maddux, he can make the ball move in several directions. And, you know, I learned that later in my career from Cal McClish, Tuskahoma Junior Caesar McClish, that what he taught me how to cut the ball and make the ball cut into a right-hand hitter and fade the ball away, sink the ball, make the ball go up and into their hands. When you can learn to throw the ball with those kind of movements, and that's what you're going to see tonight out of Freddy Peralta. That's what makes him. That's why I call him the Carnival, because he can throw just his fastball. He's got four or five different pitches. Now he's got the breaking ball, and when he's really in a good groove, he's got that good breaking ball and good changeup he has. That makes him just dynamic. But it's the ability to locate the ball and throw the ball with good movement.
But like the home run, everybody wants to see somebody pitches fast. But I don't know. I can't think of the you notice a pitcher based on the hitters, where a pitcher is so fast that the hitter has to start their swing so much. I don't know the dynamics. You know, sitting in the dugout, who the pitchers were that were the fastest based on the difficulty of the hitters, for the hitters, movement or not, right?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of guys. There's a lot of guys, Homer, when we play that. You know, there was guys that threw the ball 93, 94, 95 miles an hour, but you're looking at the hitters and they're not catching up to it. And that's where you get that explosion that guys have out of their hands where the ball has that good movement. You throw a four-seamer that the ball kind of rises a little bit. But
I don't know what that means.
Movement at the end.
It's
movement on the ball and locating it for a strike. When you can sink the ball, like some guys do, they make the ball. I'm a left-hander. I tail it away from a right-hander. I throw it to a good location down the way. The ball moves. The guy goes and thinks it's going to be there, and he's got that late tail or that cut into him. It doesn't have to move much. It just has to move probably 3-4 inches, and it changes the way the guy has to swing. And all of a sudden, you see a guy throw a four-seamer up in his zone. It seems like when you throw the ball up in his zone, you have a little bit better pop on it, a little better movement on it, and that ball gets on you a little bit quicker. It's not just velocity. It's location and movement.
All right, we've discussed this before. because I think they have way too many names for pitches. All right? Like, you not only don't, now you don't have a Tiger with Jerry Augustine. And by the way, we need to talk about Mizorowski because he's got a problem. Like, people need to know. And I don't know why they don't ever talk about a pitcher like this who throws at 102. How old is he, 23 or 24?
Yes.
Yeah, if you're that good, you're getting to the majors before 23 or 24. Why did it take him this long to get in the majors? Tell him, Jerry. Tell him this guy's problem.
Well, the problem that they have with Mizorowski and any pitcher, and what you see like Paul Skeens from Pittsburgh, those guys come in refined. They come in where they can locate the ball. I think the thing with Miz that took him a bit longer, he had some issues in the minors but not locating his pitches. And you saw a little bit last night. He got into a couple innings where he walked a couple guys.
Yeah.
Did you see what he did? He backed off the mound and he slowed the game down. Got him, collected himself together, went back out and made some really great pitches on it. That's what good pitchers do, and that's the educational part. It's not just about homer. It's not throwing the ball 100 miles an hour or having a great breaking ball or being able to do this or do that. It's about the sequence of pitches that you throw to hitters. It's about the ability to locate your secondary pitches, and it's the ability to slow the game down and get ahead of hitters. And when you do that on a day-to-day basis, you can be very good. So it's the physical and the mental part. And the mental part was probably the biggest thing that Miz has had to work with. He got to the minors, and he didn't quite understand. He was getting out of himself and not locating the ball, getting himself in trouble. Well, what they did with him, they taught him that. They went and they worked with it. It's not just the part where you go on the mound, you're physical, and you work out. It's that mental part of the game where you go and you'll be able to locate it. Because I'll tell you one thing, hitters on a major league level will figure you out, and they'll figure it out in a hurry. So what you have to do is you have to be able to be at the top of your game and locate all your pitches.
All right, talking with the doctor of pitching, Jerry Augustine, who's the nicest guy in the world. Doc, dude's got a problem. He's had a problem his entire minor league career. He walks too many hitters. And I want to tell people this because nobody else will bring it up. I don't know. It doesn't mean he might end up being in the Hall of Fame. He will not be in the Hall of Fame unless he solves walking so many. And whenever Mizorowski pitches, this is what Homer says, but it doesn't count unless the doctor of pitching agrees. I'm looking at one number only and one number only every time Mizorowski pitches, and that is number of walks. In five innings, he walked four. He cannot, will not be a successful, really successful major league pitcher unless or until he starts diminishing his walks. I think he's at, like, for his career, he got better last year. He's like five per every nine innings. Ain't happening.
That's right.
Ain't happening.
You're right. You're absolutely right, Homer. It's going to be something where you locate the ball. I have a grandson who pitches at Grafton High School.
Yeah.
Had a great year, threw a no-hitter and all that stuff.
Is he as good as you?
Is he good? Well, I'll tell you what, he's got a better breaking ball.
Hold on. This is where I have to help out Jerry Augustine. No, there's literally no chance he's going to be as good as Jerry Augustine, who pitched in the majors.
I don't know.
Whatever you want to bet, is he going to have as many innings or wins in the major leagues as you? Zero chance, and I support the kid. And if he does, people need to know how amazing that would be, because that's how hard it is to play and pitch in the majors as long as you did, right?
The biggest thing with anything, Homer, and I like what you brought up about Mizorowski, and I like what you're going to be watching, is his ability to go out there and manage one thing. Don't walk people. Don't do any favors for the opposing team. It's going to cause a problem, because what it does, it not only wears on your team because guys get on base and they get opportunities to score runs, it wears on you on the mound, because all of a sudden you got to stay that positive mind to say, I'm going to throw strikes, I'm going to get ahead, I'm going to get people out. When he gets ahead, he gets people out, and throws pitches that he wants to, he's going to get people out and he's going to be successful. But like you said, he gets in there, he goes ball one, he walks a couple guys, get some base, little cheap base hits. It changes your frame of mind. And that's the one thing that the Brewers have been working with him and think that now he's ready. And I thought last night he threw the ball well. Yes, he did walk guys, but I really liked the way he composed himself, slowed the game down, got good focus, went back and made some really good pitches. And I'll tell you one thing else with this Brewer pitching staff. There's nothing better than the two catchers that they have behind the plate. Those guys are extremely good at what they do. They make this pitching staff because they study the game, they understand it, and they know how, when a guy is out of whack, they go out to the mound and they tame him down. Yeah, our pitching, our catchers are here with Hassan Contreras.
All right, hold on, hold on. I don't want people to get upset like this. Like, you bring him on as a doctor of pitching, and then you question everything Jerry Augustine says. No, I just some clarification. So I want to get, can we take a break, and then I want to bring you back for a second segment? Because
sure. When
people bring up the catchers, my first thought is, that ain't the catcher's job. Shouldn't the pitcher know all those things? Shouldn't the pitcher know what he has and doesn't have? And shouldn't the pitcher know the people he's facing? If the catcher knows more than the pitcher, I don't think the catcher is smart. I think the pitcher ain't doing his job. But, again, no opinion counts unless it is approved by the doctor of pitching, Jerry Augustine. Second inning, next.
This is the Homer Hour on ESPN Wisconsin and the ESPN Wisconsin app.
The second inning with the doctor of pitching, and yes, he agreed with me that when Jacob Mizorowski pitches, don't check to see how fast he throws. Check to see how many walks he has. It's the only thing that's prevented him from making it to the majors until this time. And my question now for the doctor of pitching, if I could throw the ball 102, coach, I wouldn't walk anybody. Here's what I do. I get the ball from the catcher and I'd say, dude, it's coming at 102. Give it your best shot. Why would I not throw strikes? I'm throwing 102 miles an hour. Clearly, I don't know anything. Explain just how wrong I am.
You're wrong because if you throw the ball down the middle, these players can adjust. They're quick. They understand it. They've seen it before, and they'll make an adjustment.
They can hit 102.
Yes, they can. They can hit 102. It doesn't make it. If it's down the middle in a certain spots, it can be hit. It's just a matter of where the location of that pitch is. The pitching is about movement.
Can they hit 105? Can they hit 110? Can they hit 115?
It doesn't make any difference, Homer. If it's down the middle with no movement on it, they can make their adjustments and they can hit it. And that's why you see so guys like Mizorowski and Paul Skeens, and you get some of the guys, you get McGill out of the bullpen who throws 100. These guys, it's not just about throwing 100. It's about locating the pitches. And if you can't locate your pitches, you can be in trouble. You see McGill. When McGill can't get the breaking ball over, he's in trouble. He's got a good – that fastball can be hit. And what do you see his fastball at? 98, 99,
all right,
100.
I got nine. All right, you've blown that theory away. Here's my second theory. Hey, it's 102, and it might be coming real close to you, too. All right?
I like it.
I'm throwing 102. I'm throwing inside to everybody. I don't know what percentage of pitches, but a certain percentage. I want them scared. All right, how crazy is that theory?
That, you know, the part where you say I want them scared, I don't really get into that because baseball players aren't going to get scared because they know you're going to do that anyway. But the ability to pitch on the inside part of plate and show that you can throw a strike on the inside part of plate is huge about anybody who has velocity because what it does, it opens up the outer half. That's when you see pitchers, the success in pitching is being able to locate, get ahead, and expand the strike zone. We all know what that is.
So the fear is if I try inside and don't get it inside enough, then it's going to go a long ways the other way.
Yeah, well, what they're going to do is they're going to lean out and they're going to look at the ball away and they're going to go the opposite way. A lot of times they do that. Certain left-hand pitchers that are sinker ball pitchers, they go up. What do they do? They don't throw hard, but they hit the ball the opposite way. Everything with pitching is movement, location, and getting ahead. When you can locate the pitches in the four quadrants, throw it in the strike zone, locate the pitch, get ahead, get your secondary pitches over, you're going to be a pretty good pitcher. And I think this is what we're looking at, this young kid that we're watching now. He's got a big upside. The upside is going to come in the future with the education and being able to stay focused, find good sequences that he feels comfortable with, and locate the ball. And I think we got two good catchers behind the plate that do an excellent job.
All right, back to the catchers. I don't understand why the catcher has to be good at anything. No one should know the pitcher as well as the pitcher. What are you giving all the credit to the catchers for?
Because the catcher behind the plate sees these guys, the way they hit, the way they stand, how they're hitting. They study the hit. I would say that if you look at Contreras and Ozzy with the Brewers, they study the opposing team hitters as much as the pitchers do. They really do, and they understand it. I'll give you an instance. A couple weeks ago, Uribe was on the mound. He's on the mound, and the pitches were right on the zone, and he thought it was a strike. Well, he was getting out of the game. And what you saw out of him, all of a sudden, he started trying to expand the strike zone, and he was going ball one, ball two. All of a sudden, you saw Contreras behind the plate look in, and he looked and he pointed over at, he pointed to Chris Hook. He said, I got it. He went out. He slowed him down. He went out and just said, hey, you know what? Relax. Everything's okay. Come to me. Everything's good. You got your good slider. You got your good fastball. Locate. Believe in what I do. Believe in where I want you to locate it, and good things happen. He went out there. The next guy, he punched out on three pitches, three good sliders and a fastball and 100 miles an hour in the outside corner. So it's these guys behind the plate really have a good idea, and the Brewers have two very good ones that call really good games and call good sequences for our pitching staff.
Now we find out.
I got you going now, Homer. I got you going now.
No, you guys got me going, but because you're the boss. Name a catcher that made you better than you actually were, if there was such a one.
The first game I ever pitched to Ted Simmons, I pitched against him twice in spring training, and then I pitched against him against the California Angels. The third game, I don't remember what game, what year it was. I came in again. He walked up to me and he says, Now, Augie, you come in the game, you throw your fastball and your breaking ball and out of the bullpen, and you locate it and you get ahead of guys. But what do you all like to do? What do you like to do? You like to use a changeup? You like your breaking ball? How do you like to do it? And I said, you put the number down, and I'll throw it. And I threw a two-hit shutout against, I don't remember who it was against, maybe Detroit or somebody like that. I did not question his pitches one time. Every pitch I threw, if I located, it was pretty good. So I thought when I got to throw to Ted Simmons, I was very comfortable that when he said it, called the pitch, he called the location. If I hit that, I was going to be successful. And when you look at Ted Simmons, he's in the Hall of Fame. He was a pretty good one.
Yeah, he's in the Hall of Fame because he was a great hitter. I remember him only because after the game, before he would do an interview, he had to take a cigarette puff and then drink a beer, which didn't bother me in the slightest. But while I do that, I state that about him. I have read and have been told that he is arguably the smartest catcher that ever played. Now,
he knows the game. And, you know, it was always fun with Ted Simmons that when you watch, you know, Teddy, you hear so much about him that, yeah, he was a good hitter, switch hitter, and all those things like that. But when he called the game, after the game was over, if he had something on his mind about pitching, he would come up to you and he'd sit with you. I'll never forget, they brought me in the game to face Ken Singleton, switch hitter with the Baltimore Orioles. Great hitter, switch hitter, DH, great hitter. He looked at me and he says, I'm not putting any signs down. And I looked at him and I said, what? He said, he can't hit you. I'm going to put my glove in a spot. You hit it. We'll get him out. Four pitches it took me. I punched him out. After the game, he came back. He said, you know what? When you walked in the game and I looked at your eyes, I knew he couldn't hit you. So I was just going to use that. And he did. And it was successful. I was successful that night. May not have been, but it was that night. And he just had that ability to pick things up, your mannerisms, way you throw the ball, just what he had to do. And I really liked throwing to him. I thought Buck Martinez was really good to throw to, but I thought Teddy Simmons was one of the best I've ever thrown to.
Teddy Simmons made only one mistake. He was born too close to the age of Johnny Bench, because if he had played at a time with no Johnny Bench, he would have been appreciated for even how much better he was than people thought, because he could never be the best catcher in the National League with Johnny Bench.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And you know what? When you look at our club, who's our backup catcher most of the year after Charlie moved to the outfield? Who was it?
Ned Yost.
Who became a very good manager and a smart manager? Ned Yost. Ned Yost had the patience with players, but he understood the game, because every night when the game was over, Ted Simmons had a little, you know, you said cigarette and a beer. Maybe it was, but those two.
Maybe it was. And, Jerry, just right on. You don't have to say maybe it was. Just say it was. It was a different time. It was 40 years ago. Just say it was. You don't have to say what you were referring to. It was.
It was all about having a beer. But those two, Ned Yost, if you ever talked to me, got such an education from Ted Simmons, because it wasn't just one night a week or when one guy pitched. It was every night that Ted Simmons would sit down and he would say, okay, tell me three things about the game tonight. Why did you pitch out 2-0? Why did you pitch out 1-0? Why is 2-0 a bad pitch, bad count to pitch out on? It was things like that Ted Simmons taught Ned Yost, and I'm sure if you asked Ned Yost today, he would say, you know what? That was the biggest education I could have had. It helped me become a really good manager. And Ned Yost, I thought, was a very good manager.
Well, and he deserves credit for listening. I could see some point somebody going, enough, Ted, enough. Go talk to somebody else. Right? I mean.
Not Ted. Nedgar was, I'll tell you what, Nedgar wanted to be great. Nedgar wanted to have the opportunity. And he knew the position he was, and he knew how Harvey was going to use him. And he was a valuable player, but a great guy, he has a great family. I'm so proud of what he's accomplished because he was a great teammate. We were in the bullpen together for 5 years. And I'll tell you what, even when he became a manager, I used to go in and sit and talk with him. And all of a sudden, I hear a little bit of Ted Simmons in him talking to me about the game. Hey, Augie, did you see that in the seventh inning? See why I did this? I took this guy, I put this guy. And we sit and talk about it. It was so much fun. I learned myself about the game through Ned Yost. That really got it through Ted Simmons.
Not at all surprised. So how often did you or anybody take a nap in the bullpen? Come on, you got like forever there. You can't be talking and watching all the time. I've wanted to just spend time in the bullpen for a while, like where they didn't know I was there, and just see what goes on.
You know, Homer, it's all about personalities. It's about the personalities that you have in the bullpen. We had some really, really good guys, and every night it was something.
Riley Fingers could have stayed in the clubhouse and read a book or watched a movie. It's your time to come in. All right, give me this number of pitches. Nobody can hit me.
Yeah, but you know, but Riley, he was fun. It was so much. Riley would probably come out about the third inning. But when he came out, he'd come out and you just say something to him. He was the funniest guy, and he was just so much fun to be around. As funny because I one time asked him, I said, Riley, when you go 3-0 on a guy, what do you do? We're sitting in the bullpen. What do you throw it right down the middle? He says, yeah, I throw it right down the middle. That night, he got in the ball game. He went 3-0. He painted the outside corner with two fastballs and a slider. After the game, I went, I said, Riley, you lied to me. And I said, he said, what? He said, those fastballs are right down the middle. Yeah, the middle of the black on the outside corner, maybe. So, you know, that those guys, it's so unique that you learn and you have the opportunity to be with those guys. And you know, you understand because you talk about family, you talk about situation, you talk about how you can get better. The bullpen was really a fun place to be, and I really enjoyed my time out there.
He didn't say that. I don't know that Riley Fingers ever faced a hitter that he thought he couldn't get out. Like the
Never.
Only way they ever got a hit on him is in his mind when he made a mistake.
Yeah, you know, and it's just like when he got older, he started throwing that split finger. And he threw his split finger, and he said, everybody says, well, I got to come with some kind of a changeup or something. I remember when this happened. I don't remember the exact year, but I had to come up with something, and it was probably around 79 or 80. And he started throwing a splitter, and the splitter went down pretty good. But he says, I don't like that. And he's in the outfield, everybody said, well, do guys work on stuff? They do. He all of a sudden took his thumb and put up alongside the ball, and he got the ball to spin, and it sunk like almost a screwball. And that's when he struck out I don't remember who he struck out at the end of the game against Detroit in 81, but that pitch was that pitch. It was that sinking fastball changeup that he learned. I don't remember who it was exactly. I think maybe Alan Trammell, but that was the pitch he threw. And
wow.
Boy, he learned that pitch, and I'm going to tell you what, Homer, he could throw it on a dime. He was that good.
All right, talking with the doctor of pitching, Jerry Augustine, since I have you, I'm going to ask you one last question. I never worry about the Brewers because I think their GM's brilliant, all the people he brings in. And the manager is fantastic. I just, whatever they do, I'm going to support. I never asked anybody about the pitching coach. Everybody raves on them. But you wouldn't say anything negative anyway. But it just seems to me that they got special people in important positions.
They do. And, you know, it starts where I think it happened back when Doug Melvin was here. He looked at this organization, said, how can with this low budget team that we have to have, how can I make it better? And how do you make it better? You make it better by your minor league system. And he said, I'm going to do everything I can in this minor league system to make it better. David Stearns came in with the idea that saying, you know what, we're not only going to make the minor leagues better, we're going to make it educational. We're going to teach our guys how to pitch. And when they change their attitude and their culture from going to say, developing players, whoever you are, developing hitters or developing whatever, they went into developing people who could play the game, who could play defense, and who could pitch. This organization turned around. The biggest reason why this organization has been successful as of late, since David Stearns took over, was because of pitching and defense, and they still have that today.
The problem with that, though, is you can't keep pitchers forever because they're too expensive, right?
They do. They get expensive. But you know what? You got look at this ball club now, the Savali thing. Savali knew they went to the bullpen, and he knew that. You look at the minors. They got so many good pitchers in the minors that he may not ever get a chance to start. And this was his year that he's a free agent. He had to do something. I don't blame him for what he did. He's just looking after himself. It's a business thing. But this Brewer organization has developed guys not only in the major level, but they starts at the major level with Chris Hook and Jim Henderson, and they do it all the way down. And they do an excellent job because it's just not about pitching. It's just not about being able to throw the ball over the plate and throw a strike and throw a curveball and all that. It's the educational part that when you come in the game, you got to focus, you got to locate, and you got to be smart and have good sequences and throw strikes.
All right, what can you say is the best thing about Chris Hook or that people should know? I don't know that anybody gives that much credit to a pitching coach. I don't know how much impact they have, but clearly they're important based on how teams historically across baseball. I want to be on record. Hitting coach is the worst job in the world. It's like hiring someone to stop the rain in Wisconsin or the snow. There's never been a long-term successful hitting coach. It's an impossible job, but that's not for me to answer. Pitching coaches, guys hang around, and they clearly make a difference because various ones have been paid big amounts of money to go from team to team. What does Chris Hook do?
I've known Chris Hook for a lot of years. I started doing television games with the Timber Rattlers, and Dennis Krause sent me up there and gave me the first start in doing some TV work. Well, Chris Hook was a pitching coach, and what I would do is I'd go up early, like 1:30, and he would have guys throwing in the bullpen. I'd go stand with him. I'd just watch him, and we talk about pitching. We talked hours and hours about pitching, and I throw a little batting practice and that. That's where I got to meet Chris Hook, and I found out what kind of a guy he is. He's a pitching coach with the Milwaukee Brewers. He's the guy that's going to come out and talk to you about sliders and curveballs and send you to the science lab and tell you how you should stay on top of the ball and all that. But even more important than that, he's a personal relationship guy. He's a guy who builds relationships with all his players. He knows the ins and outs. He knows his strengths and weaknesses, and he builds a relationship on those. And I think the success of this pitching staff and this organization's pitching is they take the philosophy that, you know what, we're going to take whatever you do and we're going to make it better, but we're going to also learn about you. We're going to learn about the type of person you are, what makes you tick, how can I be a good coach to you. And I think that's where Chris Hook extends and does so well, and I think that's why he has that relationship, because they refer to him as Hooky. And when you talk about him, you ask him, what about Hooky? And he goes, he's awesome. And the reason is because he's not only a coach, he's a friend that builds a relationship with the guys he needs to have success with.
Talking with Jerry Augustine, he used to be known as the Doctor of Pitching. My new name for him is 94. 94. Because everybody judges a pitcher nowadays, and I have to go back, and I may have to adjust it. They have something in baseball called OPS Plus, and it factors in what the norm was when he pitched. So right now, he's Jerry Augustine, 94, because that's the fastest he threw. But when I find out that the average was lower then, I will adjust it accordingly. The next time I talk to Jerry Augustine, he might be 96, because there were guys throwing salad. Jamie Moyer, Doug Jones.
Oh, my God. Doug Jones. Jamie Moyer, the pitcher. I don't remember what. Randy, a pitcher with San Diego. I remember he threw a 3-1 shutout, 3-1 game against the New York Mets, and they asked him after the game, and I can't think of his name right. His first name was Randy.
Yeah, I'll think
of it. And they had him on the game, and they asked him, how'd you feel today? He says, you know what? I had about 6 days rest for this game. I was up about 84, 85. I was throwing too hard today. You know,
Randy Jones, was it? Or I don't know if that was
it. It could have been Randy Jones.
We'll look it up, but I know because he was good. All right, 94. Till next time, thanks for the information.
Homer, it's great being with you. I had a lot of fun.
Jerry Augustine, the Doctor of Pitching. He threw 94. Put that in perspective when you hear about Jacob Mizorowski at 102. Check the number of walks first. Every appearance. Next.
You're listening to the Homer Hour on ESPN Wisconsin and the ESPN Wisconsin app.
Tremendous power.
The Gary Ellerson Homer Hour with the Doctor of Pitching, Jerry Augustine, filling in. or Gary Ellerson. He's on assignment. And now, since we have a little time left, it can be the old-fashioned Homer Hour, 1-800-990-3776. You can call in with any comment. It's the Carbliss Talk and Text line. Liz is more. Most people text rather than call, but this is your 17 minutes. Never do this. Why? Because it's an hour show and we have guests, so you never get a chance to call in with an opinion unless somebody's gone. The Discount Liquor Twitter poll question, do you want to go watch right-hander Jacob Mizorowski play as much as any Brewers player? I voted no. Maybe it'll get to that. Not there yet. As I said, people are excited about him, but he's got shoes he's got to deal with. And I don't know, in judging the pitchers of the Brewers, like when they pitch, who you think, as far as speed, looks the most dominant. I don't know that he's that much different than some other pitchers on the team, but we'll see. But he will make it as a star only if he can figure out a way to not walk as many people. 1-800-990-3776, the Carbliss Talk and Text line. Liz is more. American Place Casino, half hour south of Franklin, just a half hour south of Franklin. American Place Casino, a half hour south of Franklin, and a spot in Franklin. It might actually be 38 minutes. It's located in Lake County, Illinois. They have great table games. They have great slot machines. They have great sports book. And they have always many promos. You go to AmericanPlace.com, AmericanPlace.com. They have a special Father's Day event. They have Happy Bourbon Day coming up tomorrow. But just go to AmericanPlace.com. I don't have enough time to tell you the greatness of all the different promos they have. But if you go there ever and you're not taking advantage of at least two promos, you're not working at it hard enough. Because it's easy. Again, American Place Casino. I am president of the American Place Casino. Just a half hour south of Franklin. Just a half hour south of Franklin. Maybe a spot in Franklin where it is 38 minutes. And I did also want to follow up for the second day in discussing this yesterday with Brian Bulaga. The standard for a superstar created by Magic Johnson, a person who can go on the road and sell the building out. I don't know who it was that just did the editorial, but they said it's not that, and mentioned something else. Well, what he mentioned was the reason why people on the road would want to go and watch somebody. The one that didn't apply because you don't think of things on the road, but the best example, 1-800-990-3776. The best example would be Tiger Woods, because it's not only going on the road, but also on TV. I mean, superstars are determined by a fan's interest in watching that athlete play, either on TV with incredible numbers or, as said best, not by your team, your home team, because they're going to support just about anybody. But when a player goes on the road and sells the building out, that is appropriately, as stated by Magic Johnson, a superstar. And you become an even bigger superstar if there's no one else at the level that you are at. For example, Michael Jordan. There may have been other superstars at the same time, but they're not equal because they're not doing it to the degree that he did. No one, you know, like Patrick Ewing or Dominic, whatever. People weren't going to see them like on the road. Why? Because they weren't as great as Michael Jordan. So what I'd have to think next, if we ever get Magic Johnson on, can you have more than one superstar at any time? Magic Johnson and Larry Bird would probably fit. But in general, the superstar, the greatness of a superstar, will trump everybody else because of his greatness, like Michael Jordan. Others, crowds won't go to see someone else because they're not as great as Jordan. So how many superstars at the same time? That's to be decided. But Magic Johnson said it for now and forever. A superstar, a person who can go on the road and sell the building out, and, I would add, create incredible TV ratings. Next.
Welcome back to the Homer Hour on ESPN Wisconsin and the ESPN Wisconsin app.
The NBA's final. I'm still taking Oklahoma City. It means if they lose tonight, they'll then have to win at home and then Indy and then at home. Brian Bulaga promised a half-hour show only on basketball if Indiana wins the finals because he predicted it before it started. Stephen A. Smith, who has become the voice of ESPN and now the voice of the NBA Finals, given it's on ABC, ESPN, commented about Giannis. Any comment about Giannis is important. Do we have it, Pebble? Hit it.
What's one word you would use to describe Giannis's career if he doesn't win another title?
Underachiever. Underachiever. Mm. I'm going to tell you why. It's one of the greatest players to ever play the game. Over the last 4 years, minimum 200 games, Giannis, second in the league, 30.4 points per game. Fifth in the league, 11.7 rebounds per game. Fifth among qualifiers at 58% from the field. And 9 All-NBA selections in his career, 9 All-Star selections, and top 10 finishes in league MVP voting 9 times. Mm. And he does, and he has more of that than postseason series wins. That's unacceptable. It's not his fault. I'm not in any way pointing to him or what he's not doing. I'm saying that you don't look at somebody that dominant, that fantastic, with that kind of fire in his belly to compete on a night-in, night-out basis, and all you have is one championship to show for it. He's got one playoff series win in the last 4 years. Ain't his fault. He's hurt a couple of times.
Right.
Got upset by Miami, right, Jimmy Butler, and the crew.
If you're
Jimmy
an underachiever, it is by definition your fault. I don't have to look it up in the dictionary. Because the correct answer about Giannis is his playoff record has been disappointing. If you say it's underachiever, then you'd say he didn't play well. And the reality is it's been disappointing because he was hurt. He got hurt. He got hurt again in terms of the number of the playoff series. Damian Lillard got hurt. So I think by definition, when you say someone is an underachiever, you can't then say it's not his fault. And that does, I don't care who said that. I don't care who they're talking about. Some of it is on the Bucks for getting rid of their coach, getting rid of Drew Holiday. But more than anything else, the disappointment in the playoffs is because he's been hurt. And I will guarantee it again, because it would appear that he's going to stay in Milwaukee, though it really isn't determined for sure until August in terms of what somebody could do. But if he's hurt again in the playoffs, you know what's going to happen? He'll be disappointing again. So you think of it more as Kawhi Leonard, but Leonard hasn't been as good in the regular season as Giannis. But they have not done as well in the playoffs as expected, but he's been hurt. And can you be an underachiever if you're hurt? I guess if you think it's your fault or he didn't take care of himself or something like that. But there's no way that he has been an underachiever. The Bucks may have been an underachiever, just as the Packers have been an underachiever under Brett Favre and Aaron Rodgers. How much of it was on the quarterback? That's to be discussed. I don't think you would view Aaron Rodgers or Brett Favre as an underachiever. The only time they ever have won a championship in the NFL is when they were first or second, or 1 year, Lombardi's last year, third, in points given up defensively. What has happened is Historically, the team has depended too much on the quarterback. The team was an underachiever, and it was disappointing. And that would be the same way you would say about the Milwaukee Bucks, based more than anything on the injuries of Giannis. So, if he comes back, when he comes back, whichever position you want to have, the most important thing above everything else is, can he stay healthy in the playoffs? Because if he's hurt in the playoffs, we know. He got hurt in the playoffs, they changed the coach. They changed the team. The next year, and they didn't do the next year, even with all the new players, they still did poorly in the playoffs. Why? Because Giannis was hurt again. All right, the NBA Finals. The game itself starts at what time, Pebble?
7:30. Well, pregame here is 6:30.
Pregame at 6:30. So they don't seem to want to do that anymore. Do you know what I want to know more than anything else?
What's that?
The time the game starts. When does it start, Pebble? Tell them.
7:30.
Next.